Hi, I'm Sanjay, and I'm a serial entrepreneur for the kicks, and I also invest in startups.
And I'm Shannon, a recent college grad working on building my first company.
And this is Startup Days,
the show where we take a behind-the-lens look at starting and growing a company from the perspective of founders and investors.
Hey, Startup Days listeners, Shannon here. On today's episode, I chat with Susan Davis. Susan is the founder and executive director of Improve International, a research and consulting firm working to improve responses to water and sanitation crises. Also, next Saturday, October 6th, Susan and I are hosting a workshop about humanitarian failures here at Prototype Prime, and we'd love to see you there. You can find the link in the show notes. Today on the podcast, we have Susan Davis. I am so excited to have her on the podcast today because she has been a great mentor as we've kind of tried to start up our company. And she has a ton of knowledge, and I think she's going to drop a lot of truth bombs on the podcast today. So welcome, Susan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Can you go ahead and give us a little bit of a synopsis of Improve International?
Oh, well, Improve International is something I founded 7 years ago as an attempt to try to address sustainability issues for water, sanitation, and hygiene in developing countries. And by sustainability, I'm not talking about what a lot of people think of, which is the environmental piece, but this is more about just lasting forever.
Yeah.
Everybody needs water forever, every day, and people need to use toilets every day, most people.
Yeah. And before that, let's go back to kind of your origin story. Are you from the Atlanta area?
I am a bit of an Army brat, so I was born in near Savannah, and then I went to high school and college in Atlanta.
Okay.
And then I moved away.
Okay.
And then I came back about 14 years ago.
And you went to college at Georgia Tech, correct?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
Applied biology.
I did.
What did you think that you wanted to do at the time with that?
I had no idea.
Okay.
I had absolutely no idea. And that's one of the reasons I go and talk to college students whenever I can, is to tell them there are really cool jobs out there.
Yeah.
I had no idea what to do with that.
Yeah. And something else that's really neat that you did while you were at Georgia Tech, rumor has it, I don't know, I don't think you've confirmed this, were you the first female buzz? Is that accurate?
That's accurate. That was me.
How did you get that gig?
Again, I do a lot of things without having any idea what is involved with them. So I just used to go to football games and I would watch Buzz. Buzz is the mascot, the furry bee. And he was so funny and entertaining. And I thought, oh, that'd be so fun. And I told my friends, oh, I'd like to do that. And so I had a friend when I was at school, who was a cheerleader, and she said, you know, they have tryouts coming up. And I said, oh gosh, I had no idea that's how it worked. So I showed up. I had no idea. I'm looking around. There's like five guys looking at me with these weird looks on their faces. And I was like, doo-doo-doo, you know. So I tried out, and you try out in the costume. So
okay.
The judges have no idea what you look like.
Yeah.
If you're a man, woman,
yeah.
Tall, short, black,
so
white, whatever.
What's the tryout? You just like hop around in the Buzz costume and try and be entertaining?
At the time, you would wear the costume, and they had like, you had to do your own skit. They had sort of an improv thing where they'd throw an item at you, and you had to interact with it. They had a bunch of students in the room. So you were like in the gym or something, and they would have, you had to like get the students excited, like, yay, and cheer. So, it was sort of an attempt at having a, you know, what you would be like in real life.
Uh-huh. Cool. Do you have any pictures as Buzz?
Totally. Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
We might need to get a couple of those and tweet them out whenever we put up your episodes so everyone can see.
I will send you those.
And what was the ratio of boys to girls at the time when you were at Tech?
I think it was five guys to every girl. And
wow,
I have to say this because people always say, oh, you must have had tons of dates, but the odds were good, but the goods were odd.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that still applies, I think.
Sorry, guys. Sorry.
And then at graduation, did they do the thing where you walked across in the Buzz sneakers? Is that accurate?
I didn't do that.
Okay. No. I heard that that's how you kind of know who was Buzz, that they will walk across in the sneakers. But were you able to tell your friends, or did you have to keep it anonymous?
It was really hard not to tell my friends.
Right.
At the time, I lived in the sorority house,
okay.
And I was carrying this big brown bag full of stinky stuff. Like, it was pretty obvious.
Did you have to take the costume to get it dry cleaned?
Oh, we didn't get it dry cleaned. I washed it in the basement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that thing reeked. Oh. Every time I meet a new Buzz, I'm like, you smell so good.
Yeah, do you think they switch them out a lot more frequently now?
God, I hope so. I was sharing that costume with two guys. And you can imagine a football game in the summer, it's hot.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have to do every game, or did you guys have a schedule that you split them?
No, we split them up. So because we did football, basketball, volleyball.
Oh, my gosh.
Parades, weddings, children's events.
That's a huge time commitment.
It was huge,
Did they give you any, like, scholarship or priority for that?
Nothing. Not
like
at all.
Like, you get to register for your classes first, or you get to use the athlete's cafeteria, nothing?
No, I did get a varsity letter. So
okay, that's cool.
I do have a varsity letter. And I got a cool jacket that said Buzz on the back, but I wasn't allowed to wear it because you're supposed to be anonymous. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's awesome. I was super intrigued by that. So thank you for sharing that. What was your first job out of college? What did you do? Or I guess even your first job before college?
Gosh, my very first job was working at Wendy's.
Okay.
Flipping burgers. And I was not great at that. I was a bad girl at Kroger. But probably my first real job in college, and I got it actually because of being Buzz, was as a corporate clown, like for corporate picnics and stuff. I was a clown or a magician. I did face painting. I could make those balloon animals.
Oh my gosh.
I was pretty good at that. I'm fun at parties.
Yeah, it sounds like it. But then how did you go from that to water and sanitation?
Well, like I said, I didn't really know what to do with that degree. Uh-huh. And tech had a really good program at the time of they would bring in all these recruiters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were tech grads, and they would come and they would interview you. So for biology, the options were the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Peace Corps, med school, and then one or two environmental consulting gigs.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So then did you get a job in environmental consulting?
I did. Okay. I did. I had been taking, as part of applied biology, they had several, they didn't have environmental courses at the time. It's kind of funny to think about that. But they had limnology classes. They had a lot of courses that were environmentally adjacent. And so I had gotten interested in water through that stuff. So, yeah, I got that. That was my first sort of paid job out of college.
Okay. And then did you work for a few years and then go back and get your MPH? Is that the right timeline?
I actually got my MPH while I was working full time.
Okay.
Yeah. At George Washington,
because
my job was up in D.C. And it's really hard to imagine that I did that, because the courses were in the evening. They were set up for employed professionals, mostly doctors and nurses, but, you know, I snuck in there. And, so I was working probably 60-hour weeks and taking three classes at a time the first semester.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you have the energy and you're passionate about it, you can kind of make all of that work.
Yeah.
Was it a little bit new at the time for someone in the environmental area to do MPH? Like you just mentioned, it was all doctors and nurses.
Yeah, I think it was new-ish. They had a track that was environmental and occupational health, but it was heavily, heavily occupational. So that's like, you know, does a building have asbestos? Does it have smelly solvents and that sort of thing?
And less focus on water.
Very little focus on
water.
I didn't learn anything about the global water crisis during my MPH, to be honest.
Well, then when did you learn about the global water crisis?
That was another kind of coincidental thing with, it's all about who you know. I had a friend, I had been working in Boston with the same company, environmental consulting, and I had a friend who met this guy, Gary White, who's head of water.org now.
I mean, just casually, Gary White, that's huge.
But back then, Gary White wasn't famous. Gary was doing kind of a road trip trying to get volunteers interested in doing events for fundraising. And so he came and he spoke to us, I think just over dinner, small group, and he talked about people are dying from unsafe water right now, and like the numbers of people and the numbers of children. And to compare that, just at the time, I had been doing human health risk assessments for groundwater that might be contaminated, say at a military site or something like
but
that.
But in the U.S., domestically.
All domestically. Yeah. And the numbers we were coming up with is like, you know, maybe in 30 years you might get one more set of cancers or something like that. And the contrast was dramatic. Here is somebody who's dying right now. So the light bulb clicked for me there.
Uh-huh. And so from there, how did you enter that field? Who did you go to work for?
So I do things in really weird, dramatic ways. I ended up quitting that job, a perfectly good job where I was making really good money. And my parents went, and then I joined the Peace Corps. And I went to Poland because they had an environmental program there.
Okay.
And that wasn't exactly what I was expecting. So I left the Peace Corps early. I came back. And weirdly, again, at the time, my fiancé at the time had been going to UNC business school. And that's where Gary and Marla from Water Partners, the precursor to water.org, were based.
Is that just coincidence that UNC also has a great MPH school and is known for their water and for their like annual conference? Is that coincidence or is that kind of, are they involved in that?
They were both UNC graduates.
Okay.
And they did have a lot of water expertise at UNC. It hadn't congealed into the Water Institute at that time, okay. I don't think. But I just went to Gary and Marla and said, I want to work with you guys.
Yeah.
And they said, we can't afford it. And I said, I'll work for free. See, I do things wrong. But I'll work for free. I volunteered for them for a few months, and then they brought me on as their third paid employee at that time. They were very startup.
That's so cool. Yeah. You were the third paid employee of Water.org?
Well, at the time, it was Water Partners. To fast forward, Water Partners, Gary and Marla kind of split organizations.
Okay.
And then Gary's Water Partners merged with Matt Damon's, uh-huh. whatever it was called, to form Water.org. Uh-huh. I think much of the same models, but mm-hmm. more cachet and money.
And one of the reasons I think that Water.org has risen to kind of be the standard in the water nonprofit industry is because they were, or Gary at least, I think from what I've read, is was one of the first people that came out and said wells aren't enough, right? And that kind of plays into the sustainability that you've focused on over the years.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Gary was the first one who said people are dying of unsafe water right now,
uh-huh.
light bulb, and a lot of the interventions that people are trying are failing.
And you were honestly probably the only person who said that to us. So I guess a little background, I haven't really talked about the work that Trupani's done so far on the podcast with the people that I've interviewed, but we were working on a device that would theoretically treat stored drinking water in rural India. And we met with Susan, and you were the first one that said, okay, here's all of these resources, here's what you need to look at, here's why it's important that it goes beyond just doing what you say that it does. And you have to look at the people that are involved, and you have to look at the sustainability of the system. So how did you kind of put all of that together? Can you explain a little bit, if people haven't heard about that, what that is?
Well, gosh, so good intentions are not enough is the short answer, right? And it's hard to hear,
mm-hmm.
right? How did you feel when I told you all that?
Initially, honestly, we kind of blew you off a little bit. We were kind of like, oh, this is just one person. We've had 80 other people that we've met with that have told us this is so great. But then we sort of learned it for ourselves when we went over there the second time we were doing this. And we kept being like, man, remember that Susan lady? Everything she was saying was so accurate. And then we, you know, started reading like Toxic Charity, When Helping Hurts, all of these other types of things. And we were like, oh, wow, we need to like meet with her again and be like, yeah, you know what's up.
Well, see, and that's great that you took that journey and you did it fairly quickly, right? But what's unfortunate is there are lots of people who aren't willing to hear it. They don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
The foundations, the people who think they're very smart, and they are. They're lovely, very smart people. But they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear that their great idea isn't uh-huh. going to save lives.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to hear that it might go wrong. They don't want to hear that it did go wrong either.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge that I have. And I keep trying to find different creative ways to get that message across. Like, it's not about you. And I'm not trying to blame you. Uh-huh. I'm trying to blame the way that we're all doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm doing it right at all, but I keep trying to find creative ways.
It's so hard because I wish that we had listened to you more and not even spent the time and the resources deploying our initial set the way that we did. But what do you do? How do you? It's kind of one of those things with any mistake in life. People aren't going to realize that until they actually experience that and like live out their own mistakes, right?
Yeah, but look at some examples of, you know, we don't just let people find out if, well, we kind of do, but, you know, if you don't wear your seatbelt, you're going to crash the windshield.
Yeah,
we don't
text and drive.
That's illegal, right? You have to wear your seatbelt. And,
yeah,
people are going to get around it. But
yeah.
There is a law that you should wear a seatbelt, right? And that your baby should be in a seat. And there are ways to tell people, mm-hmm. don't do that if we know it's not good for you.
Yeah.
But in the nonprofit world, in the philanthropic world, in the international development world, there are no laws.
Yeah.
There is no accountability. Nobody gets in trouble. Nobody gets fired. So people keep making the same mistakes.
Yeah. And it's crazy because you are directly dealing with people's lives.
Like, yes.
This isn't just saying like, oh, I'm going to try and make this device and then make it a couple of different ways, but it's fine because it's all going to happen in a lab. That's not happening. It's the real world, right? What are you pulling out there? What have we got here?
I love this, and I know this is perfect for radio, but it's a book called Watering White Elephants, and it kind of drives me crazy. It's from 1988, right? And you can look at it. It's all beat up.
Yeah.
Like, I got it from a used bookstore. It says the same exact stuff that I told you.
Really?
The same exact stuff from decades ago.
Yeah.
Why is it okay that we're still making the same mistakes? These are people's lives. Yeah. Water is a human right. Water is life or death. And why is it okay that we just, So, yeah, I get a little angry, and yeah. I try to find ways to get the information across gently. You guys were kind enough to meet with me, but I can't get my foot in the door at all the foundations. Mm-hmm. These books are very well written by very, very smart people, much smarter than me. Yeah. They're very well articulated, but they're not working. Right. So what is going to work?
Well, that's what Improve International is working for, and you guys have made a lot of progress. So I went through a little bit of a dark place where I was very cynical about everything that's happening, all of the water nonprofits and what they're doing. You know, they're building these wells, they're not testing their systems, they're acting like they have this cure-all solution that can be applied anywhere and be adopted. And it's so frustrating when you start to see it from the reality of it. Did you experience something similar? How did you get over it? And what is Improve International doing to address it?
Probably every week. I have that, I need another job. I need to work with dogs or something. I do, but I'm a weird skeptical optimist, I guess, in a way of I see this problem and I don't see that, and there are other groups trying to solve this, don't get me wrong, but I don't see anybody trying hard enough. And so it's one of those things. It's like, you know, you see a puppy in the middle of the street, you can't just let it get hit. You have to help. And so I am driven by some weird internal motivation, even though I'm not really well reimbursed for any of this. but I can't stop trying to help. So one of the things that we're trying to do is just simply raise awareness in creative ways, as many as we can. For example, I'm going to do an event. It's a conference in Kenya, and we're going to have this event called The F Word, and it's going to be a game show style. And we're going to talk about failure, and we're going to talk about why it's important to recognize failure. But one big thing, one very simple thing that anybody can do, there's no special science behind this, is just go back and look after you finished. And I say after you finish because a lot of people think in terms of a project. With you guys, you were thinking about a product and a service potentially, so you would have been theoretically engaged over time.
Yeah.
I was just trying to help you avoid some previously made mistakes. So,
yeah.
But a lot of people do a project. They say, people don't have safe water, we will give them the safe water, boom. We will give them the toilet, boom. And that happens in a lot of different ways. And then they're finished. You wipe your hands, you're finished. They're all safe. Everybody's good. And that's not the case. Yeah. And it's not the case over and over again. Just this morning, I was on a webinar with USAID-funded projects in Ethiopia. And they're like, five out of the 13 points, water points weren't functioning. People weren't paying water fees. The public toilets had actually disappeared because nobody used them. No hand-washing stations in sight. And this was work that started maybe 10 years ago. And the sad thing is I didn't even have to sit on that webinar. I could have guessed. I could have told you exactly what they were going to tell me because I read this book.
Yeah.
Because I've read 1,000 other evaluations that all say the same thing. So what's it going to take to shift now that we do know and we have lots and lots and lots of data? That's not like, nobody told me. There's tons of data. What's the incentive for change? And so here's another thing we're trying is to hold donors accountable. Right now, all of these interventions, they say, well, the community just doesn't want the water enough, or we didn't convince them, or this or that. And nobody's kind of looking back and saying, is it the way that we're working, maybe? Is it our organizational behavior change that we need to think about, not the community's behavior change?
Right.
So we're trying to not point fingers, but raise attention to the fact that the way that people fund things has a direct impact on how long they last. Or how well they work, or the quality of the water. So we're trying a donor scorecard. It actually sounds kind of controversial and maybe will keep me from ever getting a job again. But it's basically just saying two things, very simple, not even about the results, but do you have any kind of policy that says that you look back? So in the lingo, it's ex post evaluation or post implementation evaluation or monitoring, right? Just look at anything, look back. And then one thing, so that's one piece of the score. And then the other piece is, are you sharing those evaluations or data publicly? And that important piece, that's really important because we need to learn from each other. It's ridiculous that we all keep making the same mistakes, right? That's what I was trying to help you guys with. You shouldn't have to go do that by yourself. There's tons of information already. At least go in with your eyes open and innovate on other people's failures. That's it. And we're just trying to say, if we raise attention that donors say, other foundations are actually doing this, and here's what they're finding, maybe that peer-to-peer I mean, you could call it competition. Maybe that will shift behavior in ways that we can't. So there's this power dynamic, right?
Right.
With a nonprofit and anybody gives the money, the person with the money has the power.
Right, because there's thousands of nonprofits to choose from. It's like selecting a product off the shelf that you want to buy. And you can do that with where you're putting your money, where you're donating. You have the power to look into it. And I think another piece of this that makes it so difficult is all of like the poverty marketing that happens around it, right? There's a reason that some organizations get so many donations because they're so good at marketing what they're doing. But maybe through the donor scorecard, if people can look past those pretty images and see which organization is performing the best, has the most sustainable systems, looks back at what they're doing, then that will be what the focus is.
Right. And I can give an example right now, and this is because I happen to work for Marla, but they have been, their focus has always been on sustainability, on working through local partners, on going back and checking every single year, if not more often. So the group called Water First, it's waterfirst.org. I'll promote them because they actually do, they, I think on their homepage, you can go and it says, we have funded, maybe it's 2,700 projects. And they're all still functioning. All
That's
of the
incredible.
Water is still functioning. It's very incredible.
Is there any other organization that has that kind of return?
Not that I've seen.
Yeah.
Not that I've seen. Yeah. Because, and, you know, the percent of functionality within each community might be slightly less or whatever. But they know. They go back and look. That is part of their model. So, and they're not a big, they're not huge. So when anybody says, oh, it's expensive to go and look back, it costs money, then I think it's expensive to waste money on broken things.
Absolutely.
And here's the dirty, dark secret. This is what keeps me up at night sometimes. A lot of the model right now is community-based management. And to encourage ownership by that rural, poor community, they contribute cash. Sometimes up to 20% of the capital cost of a water project. They contribute labor, hard labor. Very hard labor in some cases. They're digging trenches for miles and miles to put PVC pipe in. So when that project fails, you have just taken people who make less than a dollar a day and you've taken their money and they don't get it back.
Yeah.
Does that make you angry?
Yeah.
We have to take the anger and shift it into action, right?
Right.
And nobody wants to hear this stuff, right? So people are probably turning this podcast off right now.
No, don't turn it off. Get this message out. This is so important. I think we've kind of already covered this, but is there any other common myths in water and sanitation that you want to address?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Let's see. There's actually a wonderful document called Myths of, I think it's 10 Myths of Rural Water Sanitation by a group called RWSN, and they have a beautiful set of resources.
Okay. But, yeah, I'll have you email all of these over and we can link them in the show notes so people can just go to the podcast, click on all these resources, check out Susan's website and get educated on this.
Yes, please do. So one of them that has just sort of come to light recently is for a long time people have said groundwater. So a drilled well, right? Groundwater is the gold standard. It's always safe and all you have to do is drill the well and get the water up to the people. Yep. That's not true.
That's how we got started in this space because we were in India. We were testing. It was sometimes well water. Sometimes they had intermittent supply. But we were testing that source water, the well water, versus the water that people are actually drinking. Because when you access from a well, you have to store, right? And that allows so much sanitation and poor hygiene issues to contaminate that water.
And why is it okay? And this is another thing that my friend Marla brings up is, why is it okay? So two things. One is I just talked to this guy who said that they were focused on water quality. They treat every source of water, no matter what. And he said, would I give that water to my two underprivileged children, my two overprivileged children to drink? Would I give this water to my children to drink? And I think that's a great question. That's the way we need to say it.
Would you drink it yourself?
Would you drink it yourself?
Yeah.
I go to do evaluations. And to be honest, like I bring my own water. I'm not drinking that.
Yeah.
Because stored water is dirty water, first of all. And then secondly is this this myth that you just need enough to drink is wrong. It's totally wrong. Just think of all the different ways you use water. You probably don't, you're not even conscious of it.
Yeah.
All the ways you use water, wash your hands, you know, and just the health part is people are like, drink a glass of water a day, and you know, but you got to wash your hands. Imagine cleaning up a baby after that's a lot of water, right? Cleaning your house. There's a great study that I just saw that says that associates a clean house, cleanliness of the household with taller children. And that's sort of related to the stunting issue and IQ and all of that. So you need water to clean your house and you need convenient water. Water is heavy as heck. So that's why people are storing it, because they don't want to have to go back every day. So anyway, all of this is this myth of the community water point is enough.
Yep.
It's not enough.
Yep.
The myth that groundwater is safe is not right. And we look at E. coli, but there's lots of other fun things that can be in your water, like arsenic and fluoride. And those are super hard to test for. Mm-hmm. They're kind of expensive.
And hard to treat?
Yes, very hard to treat. So there's a lot of misconceptions about, oh, all they need is just we plop in a well and then we run away and they're happy forever.
And even if you plop in a well, are they going to use it? I think about you. I think you were the one that told us about the scene in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot where they go in. It's Tina Fey's character, right?
Yes.
And they go in and the guys are all asking the women, why aren't you using the well, right? And then
no, they never ask them.
Oh,
they just keep finding that it's broken.
Oh, they just keep finding it's broken.
Yeah.
But then she asks them, right?
Yeah.
And they say something. What's their response to that?
They're like, it's our only time to get away from our husbands.
Yeah, we want to go get away from the men and go to the river and collect our water. We don't want to use the well that you built us because that's our social time.
Yeah. I just heard a great somebody mentioned this. I think it's a TED Talk, and I think they said it's called Shut Up and Listen,
okay.
Which I haven't seen yet. But my favorite piece of it was there's somebody doing agriculture, and they put in all these tomatoes, and then, you know, the tomatoes kind of bloom or whatever, and they have beautiful fruit. And then the next day, the guy shows up, the outsider, of course, and the tomatoes are gone. And he's like, what happened? Oh, well, the hippos ate all the tomatoes. They love tomatoes. Well, how come you never told me this? Well, you never asked.
Yeah.
Like, we just, there's this weird, and I get it, and I'm part of this. Like, I'm an expert. I've read all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. I know what's happening. But we don't know. We
no.
don't know the what's day-to-day life like, what people like to do, what they like to drink. Treated water is a great example because people are, I mean, even here, people are very particular about
yeah.
the smell and the taste of their water and what it looks like. Like when I go to Florida sometimes, I'm
yeah.
like, ugh, it's
yeah.
so minerally and sulfury. Or you can just water
or
it.
Or the chlorine taste
yeah.
that bothers a ton of people. That was something that we saw in India. People would pay off the local government officials that came around to chlorinate the water because they didn't like the taste of it. And that happens here. I have friends that complain about the taste of chlorine in their water.
Yeah. So imagine we're promoting chlorine,
yeah.
again, as sort of the gold standard for
yeah.
water treatment, and it tastes gross.
Yeah. Now,
again, would you want to drink that? One of my favorite things that I was trying to promote for a while, it didn't take off, was that I think all donors should have to use the toilets that they're building for poor people.
Yeah. Or drink the water from the system.
Yes, I think two things. Just make the donors go and drink the water and use the toilet. And I think that would change everything, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these organizations, too, they will have these trips where their donors go over and visit, right?
Yep.
And first of all, that just wastes so much money. And second of all, they're not using the toilets or drinking the water that's there. They're staying somewhere comfy outside of that location. They're drinking bottled water. They're bringing their own filter, whatever it is.
Yeah. And usually when you go to the community, they have to put on a big show and they dress up and they dance and they make a lot of food for you because they're being polite and that's their version of hospitality. That just wasted a whole day for them. They've just killed all the chickens in the village just for these rich people,
yeah.
you know, like might have used up all the protein. Yeah. And again, I'm one of the people who's going and doing these things. So I'm complicit in this. But yeah, there's got to be a different way.
Just to wrap up, I've got a couple more questions for you. What do you feel, and this is less wash and more just life stuff, what do you feel most grateful for?
Oh, gosh. Well, people like you who want to hear the story. I'm grateful for Prove International. It has a lot of wonderful supporters who probably don't really understand what we're trying to do, but they believe in me, which is wonderful. We have a couple of foundation donors who are fantastic and who have helped us do a lot of pro bono consulting and a lot of what I'll call activist consulting. Like, I tracked you guys down.
Yeah.
And please listen to me.
Yeah.
And we do a bit of activist consulting even for big groups, like a big company I won't name that makes toilets and things that's trying to do a water filter.
Uh-huh.
So I tried to do the same okay. thing with them that I okay. did with you.
Do you think it was well received?
No, it's not well received.
What are three qualities that got you where you are today?
Obliviousness, I think, is one that I just dive into things without really thinking through what's going to happen, like
yeah.
the buzz thing, but
yeah.
that worked out okay. I have a passion for problem solving.
Yeah.
I want to solve problems, and this is a big intractable problem, and in a way it's fun because there's so many different aspects to it. Like, what is it, technical? Is it mindsets? Is it egos? What is it?
Yeah.
So problem solving and just persistence. You know, I get up every morning, and like you said, there's those days where I'm like, oh, God,
yeah.
I'm not going to change anything. But then I have little, small I mean, you guys talking about how you shifted your thinking is a great example of the things that keep me going.
I mean, I would say you're 100% of the reason that we chose to pivot and are now consulting on water in the U.S. And trying to build a sustainable business that hopefully can then one day provide insight to water nonprofits. So
yay.
I think it's working, at least on a small scale for what we're doing.
Yay. So that's the stuff that keeps me going. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to come talk to us.
It was honestly my pleasure. Thank you.